Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 28th, 2014, and this is show number 490. Well, you know, first there was the streaming of the Apple event, which will forever go down in history as the truck slide event. I defended him for that disaster, saying it was just too many people were trying to watch. But then someone reported a mistake they made in their coding of the website that caused the problems. Bart says that explanation is horse poop, and since he's usually right, I'm going to have to agree with him. But he had no better explanation of what actually did cause the problem. It really felt like it wasn't a load issue, because the errors were so strange. I had even more trouble defending the Chinese translation overlay. That was just a total noob mistake. That was an utter embarrassment. It was made more shocking by how long it lasted. I mean, that was like a half hour that silly thing was going on, right? I mean, that's just piping the wrong audio. I make those kinds of mistakes, but, you know, you get what you pay for here. Anyway, then there was the disaster of trying to order phones. Sure, 6 million people did succeed at pre-ordering, but one wonders how many tried and failed to get in or simply lost patience. Again, I apologize for Apple for that, too. It was just a sign of how hard their servers were getting hammered. It was odd that for 2 straight hours, their website never resolved at my house, though. And also odd that AT&T's site was actually functioning at the same time that Apple's was not. But still, I defended them. Now photos and videos of the iPhone 6 Plus is bending under pressure surfacing. And, you know, that stuff even made the national news. I laughed it off, though, and I talked about how much I'm looking forward to how Saturday Night Live will spoof this. Look, I put it in a vise and bent it with a sledgehammer, and it actually bends. This is a terrible design. I pointed out that when I put my glasses in my pocket and sit down, they bend and break, too. What do they expect from Apple? To defy the laws of material science? Like I said, it even made the national news when there's huge crises in the world to talk about. Now, Consumer Reports has come back and said that, well, you know, actually the iPhone 6 Plus is even better than the 6, and it takes an awful lot of pressure to break it. So anyway, there does appear to be some debate about that. But then my apologies and explanations for Apple ran out. When they pushed out iOS 8.0.1, and iPhone 6 and 6 Pluses lost cellular connectivity and their Touch IDs failed, I just couldn't believe it. Seriously, your flagship phones, the ones you just sold 10 million of over the weekend, you didn't test this update on those? Really? Somehow you found the time to test it on iPhone 5Ss and below, and they worked fine, but you forgot about the new ones? This botched update was so bad they had to pull the update back. I don't think I can remember them ever doing that as far back as I can remember. This is an inexcusable failure on Apple's part, and I'm getting real tired of apologizing for them. I really am. I think iOS 8.0.2, I'm still having a whole lot of problems with that, too. I had my iPhone 6. I was trying to take a picture. I did the swipe up from the lock screen, and my phone locked up, turned black. Everything was off, but it was still functioning. So, like, I could press the home button, and I could talk to Siri. I couldn't stop talking to Siri because for about an hour there, she kept saying, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Couldn't do anything else with the phone. Finally, somebody on Twitter, and I should have remembered who told me how to do it, but basically holding down the home button and the power button at the same time for like 10 seconds will reboot the phone. But I mean, I'm having all kinds of weird little dodgy problems. So I don't know. I'm getting a little tired of apologizing for Apple, and I've, I don't know, kind of had enough of it.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Steve Davidson has our dumb question for today. Here's what he wrote. A few years ago, when I bought my iPad 2, those of us in the U.S. had to decide at the time of purchase whether we wanted a GSM iPad 2 to use on AT&T's network or a CDMA iPad 2 for Verizon's network, or get a Wi-Fi-only version, which I didn't want. Apple built two internally different iPad 2s. Once you picked one flavor of iPad 2 or the other, you were stuck with that carrier, or its lesser Sprint or T-Mobile radio twin for the life of the device. My impression from reading the specs on newer iDevices, iPhones and iPads, is that Apple is now making them with both carrier radio types. It looks like the hardware is capable of either, no internal differences, so you aren't locked into one carrier or another unless you buy a contract that way. The dumb question is this, is that right? Is this the utopian future really here today that we've all been waiting for? If so, that gives the consumer a lot of freedom. For example, when the new iPads come out, I could just buy one and later decide which carrier I would prefer, or get a monthly plan from the start and change my carrier later. The various carriers would have to compete to keep my business. Or I could get my wife an off-contract iPhone 6 Plus and pick the carrier that gives us the best voice and data plans. Oh, she who answers dumb questions, please enlighten me. Computationally yours, Steve. Well, I'm not an expert on this, so I had to do some actual reading and learning. I found on Apple's website a description of the different bands supported by the different phone models you can buy. They show that if you get the phone from Verizon, you do get CDMA as well as GSM, while if you get the AT&T or T-Mobile version, you only get the GSM bands. You get some other bands, but not CDMA. It seems to me that the Verizon model would be the most flexible based on this information. I put a screenshot in the show notes to the Apple page that I'm citing and the direct link to the iPhone 6 specs. I also noted on the screenshot that there are two models in there that are definitely locked to Sprint. I got that information from an incredibly detailed site on the subject called techwalls.com. In the early description, Tuan Do describes the differences between the models and the advantages of each. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing to you because I think if, along with Steve, you're interested, you'd really be better served going to the link in the show note to Tuan Do's site. And again, there's a link to that in the show notes. It's an interesting read, along with a comment section where people pose these obscure scenarios of where they live, where they're going to be visiting, and which phone to buy, and Tuan answers every one of them absolutely definitively. He appears to know what he's talking about. Now, I also wouldn't normally cite Leo Laporte as a source, but he said something on Twit that could be in concert with the tech specs that we're reading. He said he pulled his AT&T SIM out of an Android phone, and he plopped it into his Verizon iPhone 6, and it worked. It made calls and did data. Again, not a great source of facts, but he did claim to have done it, and it did align with what we had read about the Verizon phone being able to do CDMA and GSM. So it sounds like if you buy the Verizon phone, you can use it later on either network. Now, after Steve read this information I've just described to you, he wrote back, "The key takeaway of the article is that the iPhone 6, model A1549, the CDMA model, and the iPhone 6 Plus, A1522 CDMA, contain the superset of radios for U.S. carrier access, enabling them to work on both the Verizon and AT&T networks, among others. The article describes this as the Verizon version, and that as all Verizon phones are factory unlocked, it can work on most CDMA and GSM networks in the world, which is consistent with the list of radio channels compatibility that's listed in the article. So I think we have our answer here. Steve, thanks for the dumb question and forcing me to learn a little bit more about this. Now I guess I'll just sit in the corner with my AT&T iPhone that can only work on its own band." When last we left our heroes, Allison and Steve, we were trying to set up a second Drobo. If you didn't hear last week's show, the problem to solve was that we wanted a new Drobo and to use our old Drobo to back up the new one. We made a slight error by putting the old drives in the new Drobo just to test the speed, which reconfigured them so we couldn't just drop them back into the old Drobo without erasing them. We were partway through the process of copying all that data over our network to a 3 terabyte USB drive as a holding place till we put the new drives in the Drobo and put the data back. Okay, is everybody caught up from last week? Right. So copying the data from the new Drobo with the old drives over to the USB drive spanned about 5 days, but we were not feeding it data that entire time. Now remember, we were using a USB 3 drive, but Steve's iMac only has USB 2. While it was copying, we bought a Belkin Thunderbolt dock from Amazon. This dock plugs into one of the iMac's two Thunderbolt ports, and it gives him 3 USB 3.0 ports, 2 Thunderbolt ports, so he actually gains one. He doesn't lose because he lost one when he plugged this thing in, plus gives him Gigabit Ethernet, which he already had, and FireWire 800. By the way, this thing was $159 new on Amazon, but we noticed they had them used for $125, so we went that route. After the data was all on the backup drive, Steve used the Belkin dock to connect it over USB 3 this time to transfer it back to the new Drobo with the new drives. The process of sending the data back, instead of taking 5 days, took 2 days. Now, that's not a super scientific measurement, so Steve used the free Blackmagic Speed Test app to measure read and write speeds to the USB drive. On USB 2, he was getting 38 megabytes a second and 31 megabytes a second read-write. On USB 3, though, the same drive gave him 78 and 71, respectively, so almost twice as fast. Definitely, that was a scientific test. I heard about this Belkin dock from Dave Hamilton on the Mac Geek Gab. It's a great way to improve the speed on your computer, even if it's as new as Steve's iMac. Dave originally looked into it because his Ethernet jack on his iMac had started giving him 100 base T speeds instead of gigabit, and this was a way for him to get that high-speed port back without tossing out an otherwise perfectly good iMac. If you recall, the original purpose of the new Drobo was to get the increased speed of the 5N over the older FS. When Steve bought the 5N, remember he also bought the mSATA SSD, which was supposed to accelerate data across even more. I'm sorry, data access even more. So while Steve was working with all these combinations, he did several more speed tests to validate what we achieved on whether we achieved our objectives. When we started this whole adventure, we were using the Drobos over Wi-Fi, and only later when we did the math on how long things were going to take, did we drag an Ethernet cable down the hall to do the heavy lifting. I know, we should have thought of this at first, but it's really impractical in our house under normal circumstances to use Ethernet. But these were not normal circumstances, so the house is a death trap of cables up and down the halls now. I put a bar graph in the show notes of all of Steve's speed tests, but I'll run through it now for you. To simplify things, though, I'm going to average the read and write speeds, but the graph is going to show you all of the data read and write. Our original configuration was the Drobo FS with the old drives. That's what we're going to try to replace. And over Wi-Fi, we were averaging 184 megabits per second. When Steve put the old drives in the new 5N, still over Wi-Fi, very strangely, the speeds actually dropped a little bit, down to 144 megabits per second. We have no explanation for why that happened. When he put the new drives into the 5N, into the new machine, we went up to 224 megabits per second. So we're still on Wi-Fi, but we only have a little bit of an increase from 184 to 224. We got more speed improvement going to gigabit Ethernet, I'm sure you're shocked, where the old Drobo with the old drives went up to almost 300 megabits per second. The old drives in the new Drobo did much better over Ethernet. Again, no explanation for why they slowed down over Wi-Fi in repeated tests, but over Ethernet, the new Drobo with the old drives jumped up to 448 megabits per second. So that's 300 to almost 450, just moving the drives from the old Drobo to the new Drobo over Ethernet. Finally, the new Drobo 5N with the new drives shot us up to 716 megabits per second. So from the old drives over Wi-Fi, what we were doing was 184, we're up to 716 megabits per second. If we can get Steve Gigabit Ethernet in his office, he will nearly be able to fill that pipe with Drobo read-write goodness. I mean, Gigabit Ethernet, he's at 716 megabits per second, you're almost there. And yes, I'm looking into getting one of those power line adapters. I found some that claim to be gigabit, but if you read the specs, it says they go 500 megabits per second. So I'm not really sure why they can call those gigabit, and I'm asking around. Now you realize, we still have the last piece of the adventure to cover. We have to figure out how to back up the new Drobo to the old Drobo so we can justify owning two of them, right? Well, I'm a big fan of SuperDuper for my backups, but to be honest, the SharePocket software website is one of the least responsive and helpful companies around. They just pretty much don't answer anything. They say, oh yeah, ask in the forums. And the forums don't always know the answers. I popped open SuperDuper, and it was not able to see my mounted Drobo shares. By the way, Drobo calls them shares. They're like mounted volumes, really, is a better way to think of it, but they call them shares, so I'm going to go along with that. So SuperDuper couldn't see the mounted shares, and I couldn't find anything in the documentation to help me. They did say you can't back up to a network-attached storage drive, though, unless you create a sparse disk image at the destination drive, which, I don't know, that's starting to sound like a lot of irritation to me. I checked in with Don McAllister because I know he backs up a Drobo to a Drobo, and he said he uses ChronoSync. I've been wanting to play with it for a while, so I headed on over to Econ Technologies. Before I get too far into this, I have to say, the customer support is a breath of fresh air at Econ compared to SharePocket. Jennifer and I are on a first-name basis after all my questions and her great answers. The first thing I really liked was they have a demo version that's very capable, which was awesome. You can do a sync between two volumes to get the hang of how it works, and you can sync up to 500 items. You can test out their scheduled syncing operation, which will be very important in a moment. You can only run one test, and then you have to quit and reopen the software. This is just annoying enough to make you want to pay for it, but not so annoying that you can't figure out whether it works for you. It's really a good combination way to do it. They also have another option. If you really need to do more extensive testing, they have a limited time trial that's a full version. That's really, really flexible. Now, the reason I ended up bothering Jennifer was because I was looking for guidance on why I'd want to pay the full individual license price of ChronoSync directly from their website versus buying ChronoSync Express from the Mac App Store. I really, really wanted the answer to be to buy from the Mac App Store so that both Steve and I could play with ChronoSync Express, and it was cheaper at $30 than each license being $40. Like I said, if I bought it directly through the website, it's $40, so that'd be $80 for us to each have a license. Jennifer explained that the one big difference is that the full version is able to wake up a machine on the network to perform the syncing operation. Oh, dang it, that sounded really cool and like something we'd want to do, but that meant it'd be more appropriate on Steve's iMac rather than my mobile MacBook Pro. But I didn't want him to have all the fun of setting up the backups, and to be honest, in the past, he's shown a slight tendency to kind of shut off backups because, oh, the disk access sound is bothering him, or he feels like it's slowing his machine down. He's been very good lately, but I didn't want to trust him to keep this thing going, and again, I wanted to be the one to play with it. Well, as is the habit of my species, I decided to discuss this with my girlfriend, Dorothy. She knows how it is not wanting to share tech with her husband. She had an awesome idea. She suggested instead of Steve or my Mac, why not use the Mac Mini we have hooked up to the TV that hardly ever has anything to do? It was brilliant because either or both of us can screen share to it and control it. I ran a bunch of tests on the Mac Mini of ChronoSync, and it worked perfectly. The interface was intuitive and easy to learn. Basically, you drag the source disk into the left pane, the destination disk in the right pane, and then the big arrow in the middle shows you the direction the data is going to be synchronized. I mean, you'd really have to be a fool to screw this up. You have a couple other little decisions, like whether to sync deletions or not. I'm choosing to say yes to syncing deletions because we don't like to save extra data. And let's see, you can sync right there with a push of a button, and you can set up a schedule for when you want the syncs to happen. We chose 2 a.m. It was so easy using screen sharing. I clicked on the Mac Mini under Shared in my left sidebar of a Finder window, clicked on Screen Sharing, and boom, I'm into the Mac Mini in a floating window. I made it full screen so I could use a four-fingered swipe on my trackpad to flip over to it to see how it was progressing throughout the process. So much fun. I loved it. I bought ChronoSync and I started doing some syncing. The first couple went pretty well until I got to Steve's share called Large Video. Now, I don't mean to say that it went badly. Nothing's wrong with ChronoSync. But after 3 days, only about 300 gig had been synced. And we have a total of almost 3 terabytes to move over to that drive. So you know why this is happening, right? It's because the Mac Mini's on Wi-Fi downstairs. Now, there's no way I can get an Ethernet cable down the stairs around the corner, so I figured I'd just disconnect it from the TV receiver and bring it upstairs and put it by the gigabit switch, plug it in, at least for this process. That turned into a whole nother adventure, but a really fun one. The Mac Mini is now headless because it no longer has the TV connected as a monitor. When I went into screen sharing on it now, when it's disconnected, the window was really, really tiny on screen, and my mouse was moving really slowly. I mean, like, painfully slowly. And not just because this is a 2009 Mac Mini with 2 gigs of RAM. This is just horrible performance, unusable. I went into display prefs on the Mac Mini and changed the resolution to something bigger, and the whole screen went black and never came back. I rebooted it, and we were back to the dopey low resolution and the horrible slow mouse. I went off to the Googles and went for a search for Mac Mini headless resolution, and I found the answer. Turns out that if a Mac Mini doesn't see a monitor, it doesn't bother loading those silly little graphics drivers. Why would you need those? But without graphics drivers, you can't set the display, and the mouse will be all goopy. Well, luckily, I found this all out at Mac Mini Colo blog, where the unnamed author explained that you can make a dummy dongle for the Mac Mini. The idea is that if you can convince the Mac Mini that there's a monitor connected, then it'll load the graphics drivers you need. He or she explained that you can take a DisplayPort to VGA adapter, plug it into the Mac Mini, and put a resistor across pins 1 and 6 on the VGA side, and the Mac Mini will be appropriately fooled. Now, this sounded like my kind of fun. The good news is that I have a pile of those kinds of adapters, adapters that go from DisplayPort to VGA or HDMI or whatever, so I have tons of those, so I wasn't going to need to buy one. But sadly, Steve, who claims to be an electrical engineer, has no resistors in the house. I'm mechanical, so it's not my job. I'm not sure he's really an electrical engineer, but not to worry, our buddy Ron is sure to have some. I remember when our kids were little, I forget which one of them said it, but one of them told me, hey, Ron's house smells just like Radio Shack. That's the kind of geek friends you want to love to have. So I called Ron, and he said, of course he has some resistors, but he was in Florida. I explained to him that in a weak moment, he had given us a key to his house, and he agreed that it wouldn't be too creepy if I broke into his garage to steal resistors. He said it was okay as long as I didn't hurt his Tesla that was happily stowed in his garage. He cautioned me that he hadn't ever sorted these out, so it'd probably be a hodgepodge to find the one with the right value, and I'd probably want to bring a multimeter to measure them unless I wanted to spend a lot of time learning the codes of the painted stripes on the resistors. I told him that neither would be necessary. Remember during Macworld this year, Kirshen Sia interviewed the developer of Resistor Vision for the NoCellacast? Resistor Vision allows you to take your iPhone, point at a resistor at the little values, at the little stripey things, and it tells you the value of the resistor. I jumped into the App Store, paid my $2 for Resistor Vision, and I took a walk to Ron's house. Now, the author who suggested faking the dongle said they'd used an 85-ohm resistor and gave no guidance on whether that value was important. Ron said he thought anything from 100 to 500 would probably be fine. You don't want to short the thing out with too low of a value, but too high, and it wouldn't work either. When I got into his garage and started scanning with resistor vision, I was finding many with super high values in the kilo and mega ohm ranges, so I gave Ron another call. He helped me figure out what to do, but while we were chatting, he said, hey, let me try something. And suddenly the horn honked on his Tesla. About knocked me over because my head was right next to the left front. It's pretty cool that he could do that, though. Then he demonstrated how he could unlock the car, and sure enough, the door handle silently slid out as they unlocked. If you've ever seen that on a Tesla, it's really cool. I tried to get him to start the car for me, but he was smarter than that because he knew I'd just go driving. Anyway, back to our story. I got home, I built my little Frankenstein dongle with one of the lower resistors. I used one that was 290 ohms and that did work. The ones that were like 350 and 370 did not work. Sure enough, the Mac Mini will now let me set it to 1600 by 1200, which will work fine for my needs. I think this is going to bring a close, Steve and my long adventure with the Drobos and how much fun we had setting them up. I expect the fun to die down and the dumb things will probably just work from now on. I don't want to have any fun stories to tell. If there are any fun stories to tell, I will tell you. As I was figuring out how to get ChronoSync working on the two Drobos and the Mac Mini, I decided to document along the way in Clarify. It's not my usual in-depth bit-by-bit tutorial, but I thought it might be useful to some folks, so I went ahead and posted it under Mac Tutorials on podfeed.com. You know, that sounds kind of like a great segue for an ad for Clarify. Like I said, I didn't do the tutorial for anyone but me, but it's amazing how often someone else finds one of these tutorials useful, so I always share them no matter how arcane they are. This one's pretty arcane. I dropped in links to things like the Apple support article that explains how if you have an AirPort device or an Apple TV, either one of them will just magically make your Macs wake up for you if you need them. And that's a critical piece to how I'm actually succeeding with ChronoSync to do these backups in the middle of the night. I dropped in some screenshots, I blurred out usernames and passwords, drew boxes around buttons I should push next time, and made myself little notes to explain why I set switches a certain way. It's not a complex tutorial at all, or even all that complicated to execute, but I just hate having to figure something out a second time. So if you're forgetful, or even just lazy, I happen to be both, grab yourself a copy of Clarify from clarify-it.com and save yourself some time and energy. Heck, you didn't even have to share your tutorials with anyone but yourself to get productivity out of Clarify. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. Hey, Bart, we got nothing to talk about in security this week, do we?
Absolutely. Nothing happened. I didn't spend an entire week patching stuff over and over and over again. Definitely didn't happen.
You will appreciate the email that I sent to my father-in-law when he asked, so am I supposed to worry about this? I gave him kind of a light explanation. I said, basically, every sysadmin in the globe has spent the last 2 days, all day, every day, patching their systems, and you should just hope that they have someone loving at their home to take care of them when they get there.
Pretty much. I think in my notes have at some point, you know, what should I do as a user? Buy a sysadmin a cup of coffee. They're going to need it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, shall we start, I suppose, with shell shock? Maybe you can explain to us what this big vulnerability is and what we should be worried about.
Yeah. So on Thursday, I think it was Wednesday night into Thursday, depending on what part of the globe you were in, the news broke that an update had been released to Bash, which those of us from Taming the Tremor are very familiar with.
I was excited. I knew what Bash was.
Yeah, it is the ubiquitous Unix, Linux, OS X shell. So command line interface, and it's, I mean, it can be used for humans to type in commands, but it can also be used by apps to run system commands. So that's where things go horribly wrong, because the problem with Bash isn't the humans using it. The problem with Bash is the non-humans who also make use of it. And so initially this was just the Bash vulnerability, and then it took a while until a nickname surfaced, but it seems that everyone has now settled on calling it Shellshock. So that's probably what you've heard it in the media, if you've heard about it at all.
That's kind of fun, because it's a Bash, it's the shell. Born again shell, is that right?
That is it, exactly. So the Bourne shell is sort of the original shell, and it was improved, and they decided to, instead of calling it Shell 2, they thought, because the guy called Bourne wrote the Bourne shell, so the new Bourne shell should be the Bourne again shell. Ha ha ha. Nerd humor. So that's what Bash is. And the issue really is, like I said, with how stuff that's not the human uses Bash, and very specifically, this all revolves around the environment variables, which we also looked at in Taming the Terminal. And really what it comes down to is that there are applications that use Bash to execute stuff, and they pop stuff into environment variables without really checking what it is before handing it over to Bash. And you could have a big argument about whether it's really up to Bash to check that it's being asked to execute reasonable commands, or whether it's actually a problem with the apps that are doing the asking, that they should be checking what they're asking for before they ask for it. But regardless of who you decide to blame, the bottom line is that it's possible with just a few carefully chosen characters to trick Bash into executing arbitrary code. It's very similar to the whole Bobby drop tables thing on XKCD, if you're familiar with that one, SQL injection, that idea.
I actually knew what that was, but maybe you can tell people.
So if you, in SQL, if you put in a closing quote and then a semicolon, that tells SQL that you finished whatever the current statement was and you'd like to start a new one. And so if you don't check what the user sends you for quote semicolon and just execute it into SQL anyway, then you'll trick the SQL server into, say, drop all tables or something like that. Right. And in this case, it's actually, again, based on the semicolon, but it's a little slightly different. But basically, if you throw in a certain type of input, you can trick Bash into running more commands than the app that sent it to Bash thought you were running. So it's effectively command injection. And so you get to send some text over, which gets treated as a command instead of as text by mistake. And that's obviously spectacularly bad, because that is literally arbitrary code execution.
Right,
you put in
a few
symbols, and then the code you'd like to run, you pass it into some app that uses Bash, and if that app passes it through to Bash without sanitizing it, then it will happen.
So this is on Unix and Linux machines?
Yes.
Not Windows machines, and
no.
Our Macs are
Unix machines.
Unix machines.
They are. It is also in more embedded devices than you can shake a stick at. Now, the quote-unquote good thing is that just because your device has the vulnerability doesn't mean your device can be attacked. Because if there is nothing facing the network that uses Bash to do anything, then there's no way for someone who's not on the computer or on the device to inject stuff to Bash.
Okay. That sounds good.
So that's actually why Apple were able to release a statement saying that for the vast, vast majority of Mac users, this is a theoretical vulnerability rather than one we should worry about. The reason you can't say all is because many people use their Macs as web servers, and the Apache web server is one of the ways you can pass stuff into Bash.
Okay.
So, and basically, to attack a web server that's running Apache on a system with Bash is as simple as sending a HTTP header with semicolon and a few other symbols, and then the command you'd like to execute, and it just kind of happens.
What about if, say, a community had gotten together and all together learned how to make a Mac into a VPN server?
I don't know is the answer to that, but are you making that accessible to the world? You are, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I get to it from the outside.
Yeah, then you are.
So
I do not know whether or not OpenVPN does or does not suffer from this. That's something I'm afraid.
Maybe I'll have Donald take a look at that.
Yeah, yeah. Something else that's worrying for a lot of versions of Unix and Linux, but not OS X, and this is the one I didn't get clarification on this until last night. No, sorry, until this morning, actually. And the one that really worried me was that there are some implementations of DHCP, which is what we use to configure ourselves on wireless networks, that use Bash. Therefore, on some versions of Unix and Linux, simply wandering into Starbucks and turning on your computer would be enough for some malicious person sharing coffee with you to hack your machine through this particular mechanism. Thankfully...
Wait. Okay.
Okay, like, so when you turn on your computer on a network, mm-hmm. and you don't have it hard-coded to always use a certain IP address, right. which almost no one does today.
Sure.
Because that just means it won't work 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. The first thing your computer does is it sends out a DHCP request. It then receives a DHCP response. It processes that response and does its thing. There are some DHCP clients that you can inject this malware into the DHCP response and take over the machine.
So what device would be doing that? That would have to be coming from the router, though.
Not necessarily, because DHCP servers can run on anything. So you can run a little server app on, you know, I could be sitting there with my laptop running a DHCP server and just answering everyone who sends out, because DHCP is a broadcast. It just says, hello, hello, anyone out there at DHCP server? And whichever one answers first, the machine will do. So if you answer before Starbucks router, you win.
But if you're not connected to that network, how would you end up...
Well, if I was sitting in Starbucks with my malicious DHCP service running on my Mac, you couldn't tell.
I would have to connect to that network.
You would, yes, that's what I'm saying. So it's a case of being in an on a network with someone that's not trustworthy.
Okay,
so that could be a work network.
Then. So you're saying I go into Starbucks, I connect mm-hmm. to the Google Wi-Fi that's in my Starbucks, mm-hmm. then you're sitting in the same Starbucks, and you're mm-hmm. going to somehow... Even though I've gotten my DHCP from the Google.
Okay, you've jumped too far ahead. Okay, so you're going to connect your laptop to the network. You don't have an IP yet. You've only done the wireless authentication bit.
Are you saying
your
it's
machine
in
then
that split second before after I've accepted right. and before I've got DHCP, they could get ahead?
Correct. The first thing that happens after you put in your password is that your computer sends out a broadcast okay. saying to anyone out there who can hear me, anyone within the sound of my voice. Are you with the HTTP server? And if so, what should I do? And whichever one answers first wins.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So you have
this
a 50-50
one sounds
chance.
Like I'm not going to stay awake at night worrying about it.
No, seriously. It's very easy. A malicious DHCP server is very easy, and it's 50-50. So you may only get half the people, but you get half the people.
Hmm. Okay.
It is actually worrying. But anyway, don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole, because the important thing is OS X, Apple have their own DHCP client. Their DHCP client is not affected. So that is a big relief, because that was a big fear I had, that depending on how OS X did DHCP, this could or could not be a big problem. And for us, it's not a problem.
Okay. What about our Airport Extreme routers?
I do not know. But I don't know of...
Well, that's a main Apple thing.
Those routers don't... Do they have anything internet-facing on them? I don't think they do. Mine certainly doesn't.
What do you... What? It's taking the IP address from my external service provider and turning it into DHCP.
Oh, I see what you mean. I don't know, but I'm assuming they're using Apple's DHCP client. Because Apple are using their own
stuff. Right, but that's just DHCP.
Stuff.
What about, do they run Bash? I mean, are they a little
they might,
Linux
no,
server
they probably,
inside there?
They probably do, but again, the question is that exposed in some way?
I can't
and so
see why
our routers aren't publishing a world-facing service.
Well... They're the,
so the
thing
attack
that
surface.
Touches the world.
Okay,
right?
But they're...
I got a cable
no
modem shoves right into it.
Hmm?
I got a cable modem shoves right into it.
Okay.
The first thing that sees the internet is my router.
Okay, but what service application on the router is accepting requests from outside? It's only just taking packets and shoving them through.
Okay.
So it's not running a public-facing web server. It's not running a public-facing... I don't think it's running anything public-facing.
Okay, so it's more the service, not just yes. that it touches in. Okay.
Yeah, because
okay.
Bash isn't world-facing, right? Bash on its own does not touch the outside world. Bash only gets in contact with the outside world when some sort of service connects the two, which is why Macs are safe unless you enable the Apache web server or something like that, because
gotcha.
That does connect you through. You have to have something to connect through, basically.
Okay.
And on Linux systems, a lot of them do have stuff connecting through, and that's why so many of us sysadmins spent so much time patching stuff. And this has been real fun this week. So Wednesday into Thursday, the first report comes out. We all scramble in, patch, 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 patch. Thursday into Friday, it reveals that actually the first patch wasn't really a proper patch. You got to patch again. There's a patch to the patch. So we spent Friday, patch, 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 patch. And then Friday into Saturday, there's researchers saying, yeah, this mightn't actually be it either. But the last I checked, there wasn't a third patch yet. It's just people kind of wringing their hands going, I don't actually think we're done with this yet, folks. So we're in for some fun, in inverted commas. really, so being security, well, I called it medium, but for, from a security light point of view, if you run a Linux desktop, laptop, server, patch it. If you run a Mac, hold your breath. Apple have said, A, you're probably not vulnerable, because unless you've turned on SSH or unless you've turned on the Apache web server, there's no way for people from outside to get to Bash. So yeah, Bash is vulnerable, but there's no way for people to get to it, so okay. And they have a patch on the way, so just wait. All of us who have devices, be they IP, cameras, routers, whatnot, just keep an eye out for firmware. Depending on the vendor, there is likely to be many, many firmwares coming out in the near future. And so if you have a thing, update its firmware when the thing has new firmware. And then the last thing I have in there in the show notes is buy a sysadmin a coffee.
So also keep in mind your friends and relatives that maybe wouldn't think to go look for an update to those devices. I love certain things. Just some things just make you just cringe. I just looked up the Nest Protect to see whether it's vulnerable, and I got to read you the answer. I've checked with engineering, and our Nest shouldn't be vulnerable. To the best of our knowledge, no Nest device, thermostat, or protective ever been hacked remotely.
That doesn't answer the. Oh God!
No! That doesn't answer the question at all. Now, Steve Gibson had an interesting suggestion on those kind of devices. He says, if your router supports guest networks, just put them on the guest network.
I think that's kind of a good idea anyway, because all of these new devices are kind of a bit new. And stuff that's kind of a bit new is usually kind of a bit broken from a security point of view. They're going to take a wee while to bed in.
Yeah. It's something Steve and I started talking about that, you know, why didn't we do that in the first place? Our Nest Protect is a little... tedious to be gentle and complimentary to how hard it is to get on the network. So we're, you know, and it involves ladders and screwdrivers and stuff. And, because you got to connect one to the network and then you connect the second one to the first one so that they can talk to each other so that when it pretends there's smoke in one room, it can yell at you in the other room.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
The pretending.
Yeah, except for the pretending part. So anyway, we're going to get our energy up for that. And I did take the action of just unplugging my Hue lights, which I can't get to from the outside anyway, but I might as well start over on that one.
Yeah, and if they're all in a guest network, then they're away from your computers you care about. Now, that's not a bad way to operate, actually. That's quite a good way.
Yeah, I thought that was good advice.
The last thing I have in the show notes is just a list of links. So there's a nice human-friendly FAQ from Naked Security. It's basically question, answer. They seem to be really settling into that format for these kind of things, and I think they're doing a good job. Brian Krebs has a good sort of, you know, it's not Q&A, it's just a discussion-style post, but it's human-readable, human-friendly, so I'd recommend that one. Apple released a statement, so there's a link to that. Rich Mogul is a security guy who is also a Mac guy, and he writes for Tidbits and has done for a couple of years. He's done a very good sort of Mac-centric summary, so that's also linked. There are exploits in the wild, so there's a link to the relevant story about that. And then there's the bad news that we may not actually be over yet, and that is also linked in the show notes if you want to go read and be depressed. But really, as an end user, just be nice to sysadmins, because really it's up to the sysadmins to make this okay.
So exploits in the wild, from what I understand, is it's a worm, so it's jumping from machine to machine, from web server to web server, and then
joining
basically
a botnet.
Getting in there to form a botnet in order to do denial of service attacks.
Or whatever, yeah. No, the reason, I mean, people are saying, oh, this is as bad as Heartbleed, but actually, no, it's worse than Heartbleed, because Heartbleed was quote-unquote only leaking out information, and leaking out information is not good. But in this case, you get to run commands, which means you have the ability to spread yourself. Because if you run a command that says install myself, and then you go searching for vulnerable machines, you find them, you run the command install myself, and it just ripples out from there.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is, you know, that is what a worm is, and that is what is slowly happening. But thankfully, I think a lot of sysadmins are on the ball. So, knock on wood.
Yeah. One can only hope, like you say, be nice to the sysadmin.
Yeah. So unless you have any more questions, that's probably enough shell shocking.
I think I've got it. I find it fascinating how much this stuff is making it into the mainstream news these days, though, don't you? I mean, my father-in-law heard it on the morning news.
Which is good, actually, because really, we rely on the internet for so much of our life that internet problems are as important as traffic problems on physical roads.
Yeah, yeah. I do want to end with, I got to find it. George Starcher had the funniest quote today. Hang on. Did I spell his name right? Go to user George Starcher. Did I spell him right? Yes. Here it is. His, wait. This is worth it. It's worth it. The security posture of your org should not be curled in a ball crying.
Yes, that's always a sign that you've lost.
And on that note.
Indeed. So popping into plain old security light, which also is not a particularly empty section of the show notes, unfortunately. Uh-oh. So updates. Okay, iOS 8.0 came out. That is a very significant security update, which means that devices that are stuck on iOS 7 have now not gotten some really critical security updates. And in the words of Intego, if you care about security, throw away your iPhone 4 right now.
Oh, dear.
You know, I'm afraid it has been obsoleted. You can choose to take the risk because at the moment there aren't that many people exploiting iOS, but know you're taking a risk because it is that.
Yeah.
Then Apple went and made people cranky. So iOS 8.0.1 came out and it was not without its problems. It wasn't that it broke every phone, but it did break a lot of phones and it made a lot of people angry. So Apple did the right thing and pulled it, which is obviously the right first response. Then they made a second response, which was here's instructions for downgrading back to 8.0, which is also a good response, followed by and we're working on 8.2, we'll have it out in a few days, which is also a good response and also what they did. So as of right now, 8.0.2 is out, and from what I gather, it is free of these whoopsies.
Yeah, it does appear to be working better than the one that didn't work at all.
Yes.
I mean, that was pretty bad. That was pretty bad.
Indeed. Yeah, no, it's not good. But look, this happened to Microsoft just last month. I mean, no, not even last month. Was it this month?
We're as bad as Microsoft?
No, our defense is... You know, people make mistakes. All companies are made of people. All companies will make mistakes. So we talked about it, I think it was the last Chit Chat Across the Pond, where we said the one message you should never take away from a botched update is, I'm never going to update again.
Right.
Because if you do an update, there's a small risk of it going wrong. If you do not do an update, you are guaranteed you are insecure.
Right. I think it isn't the worst idea to give some of these updates a bit of a...
Give them 24 hours, you know, sleep on them.
Yeah.
Well, give them a week.
8.0.2 is not a security update, though, right?
Well, I don't know. I didn't actually check what its content was. I think it's more likely a bug fix update because, 8.0 will have had a few bugs in it because it's very new. Okay. I don't know. There could be security bugs. I didn't actually check that. I should have done.
Okay.
Anyway, there was also a significant update, which is actually more significant than it sounds. So Thunderbird and Firefox was updated to yawn. Okay, that happens, whatever. Now, the reason this is actually a much bigger story, and if Shell Shock hadn't have happened, this would have been our lead story. So Mozilla, so Firefox and Thunderbird, the bug that was fixed in those was a bug with how certificates are validated, which was described as basically an adware-friendly bug because it meant you could have fake certificates, therefore you could spam people and all sorts of stuff. The thing is, what Firefox and Thunderbird use for that verification is actually a separate package that's available without the browser as a separate little package. It's called the Netscape Security Services, or NSS, and it is used to do certificate validation in a kabillion different versions of Linux. So this meant that a whole bunch of Linuxes were not able to properly validate security certificates. But this update came out about the same time as the first of the Bash updates, so all of those sysadmins who were patching like crazy got this one for free.
That's a good thing?
It's a fantastic thing.
Oh, okay.
Because I saw it myself. Every server I went to, I did a Yum update, and I saw Bash NSS. They just came through together. So all of those sysadmins running around fixing Shellshock have inadvertently also fixed this.
Well, that's handy.
It's fantastic. So I don't even have to spend much time talking about it. It would have been a big story, but it's not, thanks to Shellshock, which is kind of weird.
Apple riding also like a moray on a shark.
I know, it's kind of cool. Apple then also put out 10.9.5 for OS X, as well as security updates for OS X8 and OS X7. Also a security update to the Apple TV, which is now at version 7, and our friends at Adobe put out an update to their PDF products, which is Acrobat and Reader, and that is all the updates.
All right.
Then in security news, we should quickly mention that Apple have made good on their promise. Two-factor auth has been rolled out to protect your iCloud backups. Google nipped a nasty bit of malware in the bud. So, you know the way I keep saying that it's not okay to surf the web unprotected if you, quote-unquote, only go to legitimate sites, and that you're only in danger if you go to, like, dangerous places? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that every site has ads. And ads tend to come from the lowest bidder. And what happened here was that an ad company used by Ad DoubleClick, owned by Google, got some ads from a bad source. So, right, there's a lot of indirection there. Mm-hmm. But the point is, malicious ads ended up on Last.fm, the Times of Israel, and the Jerusalem Post. Those are mainstream sites. That is not the underbelly of the web. And there was malware on those sites briefly.
So I have actually heard three humans I know in real life getting basically browser hijacks on their Macs with ads popping up all over. Tim Robertson of MyMac.com and all that, he wrote this nasty thing on my blog going, why do you have all these video pop-ups? Your site really is horrible. Yeah, I don't have any ads on my site. If you look carefully, it's like, no, it was you. So, yeah, and these are fine, upstanding people, I'm sure, are not out on, you know, gambling porn sex sites, you know?
Yeah.
That's not what's happening here. So,
no.
But it is affecting the Mac.
It is. But that can also be is there's a lot of unscrupulous legitimate software that installs helpful tools for free along with what you actually wanted to install, like all of these bloody banners that even, frankly, supposedly legitimate companies like Adobe sneak in. You know, Adobe keep on pushing that bloody Yahoo banner as a Yahoo toolbar thing.
Yeah.
Sneak that into security updates. And it's not good. So a lot of that stuff sneaks in through not paying close enough attention to the installer of stuff. It says, oh, yeah, I'll give you that too. And if you don't read very carefully and unclick it, whoopsie-daisies. And also through drive-by stuff if you don't keep your Mac patched. So, yeah, anyway, yeah, it's a myth that you're safe if you stay away from the underbelly, and this just proves it yet again for the 5 millionth time. What I think everyone should read is Apple's new privacy statement and Tim Cook's open letter about it. To me, it's just Apple doing the right thing. And we spent ages on this show talking about my follow the money theory. And so I don't want to go over it all again. But Tim Cook basically said you should follow the money. I remember going, woo!
Yeah, yeah. He was definitely channeling you. There's no question about that.
So as I say, lots of links in the show notes. And it's all very human friendly what Apple have written. And I like it. It's the right idea. And then there's some bad news for people on Android before version 4.4. Basically, you have some serious internet security problems because the default browser and default HTML rendering engine fails to do the most important thing of every web browser, which is to keep websites separated from each other. It should not be possible for an ad on one page to read the details in the login box of your bank's website in another tab. But on Android, it is, for versions before 4.4. And that is the case that Google have patched it, but again, how long is it going to take these patches to ripple to people? And are there lots of people out there whose carriers will never pass on the fix?
Now, isn't there a different browser that most people use?
Right, so after 4.4... this built-in browser has just gone completely. Before 4.4, this code was in there as the default. If an app says show some HTML, that's the engine that does the rendering, even though they may also have another browser for browsing the web. So they sort of have the code and haven't the code.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah. So it's you know the way IE is sort of wedged into Windows even if you use Firefox?
Yeah, yeah.
Same idea. But in this case, it's that code is wedged into old versions of Android before 4.4. So, you know, going forward, problem solved, but for people with older Android phones. I'm always running out of breath here on the security stuff. I don't know if any of these names are big because I don't live in America, but apparently Jimmy John's got themselves breached 216 stores. Apparently they make sandwiches.
Never heard of them.
Okay.
I don't get out much. Doesn't mean it's not a big deal.
Their vendor then is actually where the breach came from, and their vendor says, oh yeah, we also seem to have leaked details from 100 other independent restaurants too. So it's actually 316. TripAdvisor Viator, whatever that is, lost 880,000 credit cards. I'm assuming that's significant. And then we got a whole bunch more details on the Home Depot breach we talked about 2 weeks ago. Links in the show notes for anyone who's interested. It's just all bad news, really. 56 million cards. And then finally, there's a whole bunch of suggested reading. I want to get through quickly, so I'm just going to say that if you've ever wondered, how much is this metadata that the American government keeps telling me I shouldn't care about the fact that they're slurping up? How much does that tell them? Well, a Dutch guy decided to do an experiment and gave the metadata to security researchers for a month and said, tell me about me from what you can learn from this. And the answer is they learned an awful, awful, awful lot. If you're interested, have a read. I highly recommend it. Cloudflare did some really cool stuff that's going to make it easier to have secure websites for large-scale stuff. Go have a read if you're interested. And just sort of end on a happy note. Well, it's not a happy note, actually. Printers are really insecure. Don't point them at the internet. And to prove a point, a hacker at a conference installed a fully working version of the platform game Doom onto the teeny tiny screen of a printer.
And so, you can actually play it with wait a minute. So my printer, I can email to my printer and it prints. That doesn't mean it's on the internet, does it?
I don't know. Is there some sort of cloud service that connects into your printer? How does that work?
I don't know. I was on my printer. It has a thing that says, do you want to be able to email to it? This is the email address. It's going through something from the outside.
It is, but I doubt if you were to scan your router, you would see the printer.
Okay, probably not.
Whereas what tends to happen in corporations and stuff, they have a bunch of public IP addresses, and if you scan their IP range, you find printers on the internet. And that's just cannon fodder. So don't do that.
Okay.
And then there's loads more stuff in there, but I'm fed up with security talk now.
All right. Do we get to get back to taming the terminal now?
We do. So this is part 21 of N, and this is a wrap-up of searching. So two installments ago, we did egrep for filtering text. So be that a flow of text being piped to it, or be that a text file that we read in. But so, either way, we're looking for something within text.
I want to tell you that I used that in, I think the example you did was, let's find everything on your hard drive bigger than a gigabyte. And I found...
That's the find command. That was the next thing.
Oh, shoot. That isn't searching? That's finding?
Well, no, that was... Okay, so the first thing we did on searching was egrep. And then the week after, we did find. So egrep is about filtering text, and find is about finding files. And so the find stuff is, I think, where your ears pricked up and you had a great time. And it's the find thing that you are going to tell me about now.
Okay, so the find thing, we did the find thing to look for files bigger than the gigabyte, and I found a whole bunch of movie files that I did not need to keep. I had three copies of my video interview with Robert Lloyd Lewis from Dexter, and you know, while having one copy of that might be a good idea, I did not need three of those. And I think I cut out about, that wasn't the only thing, I found a bunch of other stuff like I totally don't care about, or I've already uploaded it to YouTube, or I've got it on the Drobo, you know, I don't need to care at all.
Excellent. So house cleaning, good. So that was the second thing we did. And then we sort of left off at the end of that saying, and by the way, Find has one more trick up its sleeve, and then we have some cool stuff for Mac people only. So let's start by revisiting the end of Find. So last time we learned that we can use Find to basically specify a whole bunch of criteria and have it spit out all of the files that match that criteria in the folder we're searching in. So you said Find, where to look, what to look for. And then it gave you back a load of stuff. And then I sort of ended by saying that, well, it can do more than just give it back to you. It can actually run commands on whatever you get back. Hmm. Now, this has the advantage of being really powerful and the disadvantage of being really powerful. Right? You can, and it is something you will see done on systems. So imagine you have a cache and you're just trying to keep a local copy of some stuff that, you know, you don't want to have to re-download again, but you don't want to keep it forever because it'll just waste your hard drive. So maybe your cache has a lifetime of a day. And so maybe once an hour, a little script runs that deletes everything that's older than a day. Well, the find command can help you find everything that's older than a day. And then you can use this feature we're going to talk about to find and delete everything older than a day.
But sounds if you make terrifying. A mistake,
Yeah, right. If you make a mistake and find goes off and finds way more than you meant it to find, they will also delete way more than you meant it to delete. So
I'm not typing any of these commands, Bart. You're terrifying.
No. None of my examples today are that kind of evil. So what I would say is this can be very useful to do non-destructive things to files, but think twice, three times, four times, five times before doing destructive things to files. Okay. So if you do really need to do something destructive, run it, you know, lots of times without actually doing the execute bit to make sure you're getting back everything you want and nothing but what you want, and then do the dangerous bit. But you can use this non-destructively. And we have the examples we have today are non-destructive. They're not going to delete anything.
I like the way that sounds. I'm back with you.
And there are non-destructive things you may want to do. And it's actually a very good way to automate things. The find command can execute commands in two modes. So it can either execute the command once for every single file it finds, or it can execute the command once in total, sticking all of the files as lots of little arguments to that one command. So you can have one command over and over and over again, or one gigantic big command with all of the results as arguments. There are the two modes it can operate in.
Okay.
So let's start with the first of those modes. So the flag to make it execute stuff is minus exec. And so when you type, you have find where it is you're looking, what you want to look for, then you say minus exec, and then you type the command you'd like to do to those files. And then at the point in the command where you want to stick in whatever find found, you put open curly bracket, close curly bracket. That's basically insert here, is how you should read that. And then when the command is finished, you put inside single quotes the semicolon.
Really? Okay.
It sounds horrible, right?
It looks pretty bad, too.
Okay, but let's assemble a command in pieces. Okay. You know, Lego bricks, and we'll build it up. So we learned in installment 6 that you can make a file executable with the command chmod 755 and then the file.
I remember that one. I use that a lot.
Yeah.
I would like have to use it a lot, but I have one place I don't know how to get around without it.
Yeah, no, it's handy. Now, it's very common to need to make scripts executable. So PHP files for a lot of people, Perl files for me. So the example is, I just want to find all my Perl files and make sure they're executable. And so we can find all our Perl files because we know they all end in .pl. Okay. So we know from last time that it's find where you'd like to look minus name star .pl. So if we take those two small pieces of knowledge and we mush them together, we can do something useful. So let's say that all of my Perl programs are in a folder called documents scripts.
Okay.
Seems like a sensible place.
Right.
So I could say find /documents/scripts -name star.pl escaped inside our single quotes so that the star isn't interpreted by bash -exec chmod 755 pair of brackets -semicolon inside single quotes.
Okay, so let me see if I can explain that. So you said find in this location documents/scripts. I'm going to search by name, so I'm going to say -name. And then you said start.pl because we're looking for all of our Perl scripts. Mm-hmm. And then minus exec was the execute. So we want to execute on the files it finds the command chmod 755. And we, for some reason, throw a pair of brackets and a semicolon at the end of that.
Okay. So the pair of brackets tells find where it should stick the Perl file it found. So where in this command do I insert what I found? It's the placeholder. So if I find a file called myscript.pl, the command executor will be chmod 755 myscript.pl.
Oh, so you're going to put something inside those squirrely brackets?
No, you don't, right? Find does. That is the place where find inserts the results before executing.
Where is open close squirrely brackets? Where is that?
It's 755 open close curly brackets in the command.
No, I know, but you're saying the, and I know I'm calling squirrely brackets just to irritate you, but
yeah, it's as good a name as any.
If you got this pair of squirrely brackets, how is that telling it where to put it? What it seems like you'd put something between those squirrely brackets to say put it here.
No, the squirrely brackets mean it goes here.
Where?
Where the squirrely brackets are. The squirrely brackets mean insert here.
Here in the command?
Yes.
Ah, not here as in /document/renamed scripts.
No, no, because it's going to execute chmod 755 something. And so you got to, you know, you got to tell it. So it's going to find Perl files and then it's going to run this bit of command. And it needs to know where in the command you've typed it should put in its results. And so the squirrely brackets just mean results go here.
Okay. I'm glad you're saying squirrely brackets now, too. I think I understand. But okay, keep going.
And the semicolon inside single quotes means this is the end of the minus exec.
Okay.
So minus exec.
Oh, because you might want to add more.
You might. You can actually add more than one minus exec.
Okay. Okay.
If you want to do two things to every file you find, you could have another minus exec after that.
I hate to say this, but since we're talking to Bash and we've been talking about the Bash vulnerability, this is part of that, like, we're running little commands here, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
These are serious
the context is great because now we understand more about what it means. That's actually pretty helpful.
So in our example there, that will simply change all of our Perl files to be executable, job done. So instead of, you know, first finding them all and piping them to a file and then taking that file and copying and pasting it each time and running a chmod 755 and each thing in that file, we're just doing it all in one go, say, go find me the Perl scripts, and when you find them, do this to them. And that's very useful.
Okay.
Another thing, so the other mode is instead of, so in this case, if there were 10 Perl files, that command would be run 10 times. chmod 755, the first file. chmod 755, the second file. And so on. So it's one execution for every result. If that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
The other way you can do it is instead of having one execution for every result, you can have one execution in total. And instead of only sticking one result in where the squirrely brackets are, you stick all the results in there. And you run it once.
Okay, right, right, right.
And the reason you might want to do that is because some command, if you want to do some sort of calculation, you want everything you're calculating on together. And so the practical example I'm going to use is I would like to find how much space, or no, how many lines of code I have actually written.
Hmm.
Right?
Okay.
So I'm doing a report for my manager and I want to show how busy I've been for the last couple of months. How much Perl have I written? Well, I need to find all my Perl files. And then I need to do a WC minus L and give me the sum. Right? That's what I'd like to achieve.
Okay.
So we learned. Okay, so the first piece of information is if I want to count all of the lines of code I've written, it's not just the Perl scripts, which are the .pl files. I also need the Perl modules, which are like library files. So they're PM files. So this time I've got to find PL and PM. So the find command is now find where I want to look minus name star.pl. Minus or, minus name, star.pm.
Okay, so we're just saying, look here for the name .pl or the name .pm.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that will give us all of our Perl files. Now, back in installment 15, we came across the word count command, WC, which has nothing to do with water closets or public toilets. It's for word count. And its mode, it can take a flag of minus L, which says, don't count words, count lines. So WC space minus L counts lines. And then you can specify one or more files that it should count. So you can have one file or you can have 100 files.
Right.
WC minus L will happily take and do its thing. So if we put all of that together, we can create one file that will find all the files, stick them all into WC minus L and give us the total.
Okay.
So find where you'd like to look now. Do you remember last time I said that sometimes you have to group things together with brackets?
Yeah.
If we don't group them together in this case, because there's a minus or in there, the find command might get confused as to whether the exec should apply to only the PM files or to both.
Okay, so this is just sort of like when you're saying x times the quantity 4 plus 6,
you want
to put it inside parentheses, right?
Exactly. Just to be clear, that I want you to execute on all of this. So it's open parentheses, minus name, star.pl, or minus name, star.pm, close the parentheses, minus exec, WC minus L, our squirrely brackets, and this time, instead of ending with a semicolon, we end with a plus. And the plus means don't do this every time, do it once, with all the things we find as arguments.
Don't do it every time.
Okay. So in the first example, we ran chmod once for every Perl file we found. So chmod the first file, chmod the second file, chmod the third file. This time we're going to run WC minus L once, with all of the files as arguments. So those curly brackets are not replaced with one file, they're replaced with every file we found. So it's going to be WC minus L, file 1, file 2, file 3, file 4, file 5, file 6, file 7, okay. file 8, and run okay. once.
So the plus says run it over once. And over and over. No, don't run it over and over again. Just run it once.
Yeah, so the plus, the way I think of it is the plus says add them all into one big command.
Okay.
So to make this a little more practical, we, a few weeks ago, played around with xkpasswd2. Right. And we installed it onto our Macs in user local xkpasswd.pm.
Right.
So if we want to find out how many lines of code that took, we can use the same basic command. And so if you copy and paste that, it's the same as what we did before with one small thing where I just want to say, don't include folders. So the minus not minus type D says exclude folders because I called the folder name .pm and it was being picked up because .pm ends in .pm. Right, so I just had to put that in there because I was silly in my naming convention.
Okay.
So if you copy and paste that into your terminal, what you will find is that there is a total of 4,136 lines of code.
Huh. Wait, I thought this was word count. Did I lose track?
Right. WC minus L means count lines.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Right. Okay. Got you. Caught up.
Okay. So another example to try and make this more practical is that you may want... Okay, so we talked about finding big file wasty file wasters. And you said to me last time, I'd like to know how big each one is. And I said to you, that can be done, but I'm not going to tell you now. Well, now I am.
Okay.
Because the du command calculates disk usage.
Ah.
And so if we find all the files we're interested in and then run them through the disk usage command, we'll know how big they are. And so if you take, so the example we have is find --downloads, because that seems like a place people might have big files, minus size plus 500M, everything bigger than 500 megabytes, and then we say minus exec, du space minus ch, and then our squirrely brackets ending in a plus.
Wait, did you already tell me what ch means?
I didn't.
Okay.
The H means do it in human readable format. So don't talk to me about 5 kabillion bytes. Tell it to me in megabytes, gigabytes, and so forth.
So what does CH stand for?
So the H is for the human readable.
Oh, okay.
The C bit tells it to sort of add them all up and give you a sort of a total at the end. I'm not quite sure how C becomes total.
Okay.
But that's just what it means. And so if you run that, and if you have any such files, you will see each file with its value, and at the very bottom it'll say total and how much space you're wasting.
I'm wasting 4 gigabytes of space in my downloads folder. I have my the two iOS 8 Gold Masters sitting in there. I might go delete those.
Well, at least the least recent one.
Well, no, they're Gold Masters. I don't need those. They're not the real
you don't,
thing.
Sorry, because it's out. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Wow. Oh, and I've got them uncompressed, too. I've got a zip version of them. Where did it find both of those? Oh, maybe that is the two. Okay, that is the two that it found. Okay, gotcha. All right. I just got 4 gigs of disk space back. Thanks, Bart.
There you go. So I also think I promised there will be a nerd joke at the end of this find segment. And there is.
Okay.
So find in slash minus iname starbase star minus exec chown minus or us squirrely brackets, semicolon. Do you get it?
Wait, you typed it differently than you just said it. So say it again.
So find slash.
Okay, so everywhere.
Minus iname.
Iname. What was iname again?
Case insensitive name.
Okay, all right.
Star base star.
Okay.
Minus exec.
Uh-huh.
Chown. Minus capital or us, squirrely brackets, semicolon.
All our base are belong to us.
Correct. In fact, that is the command to make it so.
I love it. So you said find case instead of name, anything with the word base, so all our base, and mm-hmm. we want to execute, change the ownership recursively to us.
Yeah. I have that on a t-shirt.
That is so dorky. I love it. Actually, it's going to help me understand the commands better now.
Excellent. And I've been wearing that t-shirt for quite some time, and I'm sorry to say not a single person has ever said, oh, I get that. Everyone says, what?
Oh.
I have to explain it, it's not funny anymore.
Okay, so find.
Yes. So that is it for the find command. We've now, last time we learned all about how we can search, and now we've learned that we can use those searches to execute commands on everything we find. And that's where our Linuxy friends can come this far with us, but now we're going to leave them behind.
Okay.
Because there's one extra little cool thing only Mac users can do.
All right.
So we discovered last time that it can be very slow to set find loose on your entire hard disk because it has to go into every file and every folder, check if it meets the conditions, and then go on to the next one.
Okay.
Takes ages because it's doing the work every single time. OS X has Spotlight. And one of the ways that Spotlight works is that Spotlight actually has an index. So there's a little indexing process that indexes every file in your system that's not in a place you've told it to ignore.
Yeah, everybody knows about that because sometimes it goes crazy. That's why it's there.
And then we have to make it recalculate the index by deleting it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why when you click on the Spotlight icon and start typing, you see results straight away. It's not searching your hard disk. It's just looking them up in the index. And as you know from going to a library, going to the index catalog is much quicker than walking around the whole library. So wouldn't it be great if we could use the power of that index from the command line instead of having to use find, which is the equivalent of walking through the whole library very quickly? And the answer is that Apple were good enough to write their own command line tool for exactly that. And it's called MDFind, Metadata Find.
Huh.
And so at its simplest level, it's MD find, and then inside single quotes, whatever you type into the Spotlight window.
Okay.
And then you hit enter, and it gets back all the files. Now, there's some caveats here. So, firstly, this is not equivalent to Spotlight in the menu bar. It's equivalent to Spotlight in the Finder. And the difference is that Spotlight in the Finder does slightly less than Spotlight in the menu bar.
It does?
Spotlight in the Finder won't let you do math. It won't let you say 4 plus 6 equals. It just finds files.
Okay.
So this is just for finding files.
Okay.
So that's just the first caveat. The second caveat is that anything you've told Spotlight to ignore, MD5 cannot find. So I have Spotlight told to ignore my temp folder because that's where I make podcasts. And as you've said many times, when you're making podcasts, you make these gigabyte big files that last for like a few minutes, and I don't have them ignored from Spotlight. I have them ignored from Time Machine.
Yeah, that makes more sense. I was thinking, what, you think it's going to try to search that AIFF file? Well,
actually, no, never mind. I don't actually have them ignored. But you may have stuff ignored because you may want network drives not to have those the little hidden files Spotlight makes popping up on network shares. So you may have added your network shares to the ignore list. So basically, if you've added stuff, if you've told Spotlight don't index this, MDFind will never find it because it's not in the index.
Okay.
So as an example, if you want to find all the PDFs on your system, MDFind, /PDF, inside single quotes, hit enter, all your PDFs will scroll by.
Oops.
Shoot. And in my case, that's a lot of PDFs.
I'm doing a better one. Hang on a second. This is going to be hilarious.
Okay, good.
But I got to not do a typo. There we go. Let's see. Nope, that didn't work.
Oh.
What I was trying to do, I did a search on my drive for how many times I said the word booger. actually, no, it might be, no, boogers. And it found a whole lot of files because I tend to do that. but I noticed it was in a bunch of emails and they end in EMLX. So I tried saying MDFind, single quote, kind.EMLX, space, boogers, close, single quote.
Well, no, because the kind wouldn't be EMLX. The kind would be email, probably.
Okay, well, let's try that. You think email?
I'm just guessing.
I didn't find it either.
Okay, because the kinds are usually, because kinds are stuff like, it's not JPEG, it's image. So the kinds are the prompts you get when you do a drop down in Finder.
Can
if I you get, say kind, colon.
Can the terminal tell me what kind it, what the kinds I get to choose from are?
No, this is not as well documented as you would like.
Well, I need to be able to find all my boogers' emails. You know, it's important stuff.
Mail message. Kind:/mail message, I guess. Or kind:message.
Let's try message. This is important stuff. No, we'll try mail message. I think we should take a lot of time of the listeners for me to try to do this. It's my show. I could do what I want to. Yeah, no, I can't fight it. Okay, well, moving on. That's kind of interesting. Now, why is that easier than doing it in a spotlight finder window?
Well, because maybe you're automating some stuff and you want to be able to do this in some sort of little script. Because remember, anything you can do in the terminal, you can script.
So if you can do it
on the terminal, you can do it automatically.
Right. If you dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was thinking that. I just had to say it.
Strangely enough, I wasn't, because I guess that's an Americanism. I've never heard that before.
It's from the movie Dodgeball. A very highbrow, intellectual movie you really should see.
Yes. So you can stick in there lots of stuff. So inside your single quotes, you could say kind colon PDF space boogers to find all your PDFs with boogers in them.
Mm-hmm.
So basically anything you would put in the spotlight window. And it also has stuff like date colon today is also something that works in spotlight. So date colon today, kind colon PDF, every PDF you edited today. Okay. And so on and so forth. Now, I have not been able to find the definitive list of the actual syntax for Spotlight, but if you stick Spotlight syntax into Google, you get lots of different results, and each of them tells you something cool. Just nowhere tells you all the cool stuff together.
Hmm.
So I'll leave it as an exercise to the listener.
Need an index of the indices?
Yeah, I kind of do.
Okay.
Now, there are a bunch of flags that you can use with MDFind, and if you want to see them all, I'd say man MDFind, but there's two of them I just want to bring to your attention because they're probably the two most useful. So by default, MDFind searches your entire computer, or at least every bit of your computer indexed by Spotlight. If you don't want to do that, if you only want to see the folders in your the matches in your documents folder, say, if you look for boogers in your documents folder, all of those emails will vanish because they're not in your documents folder. And the flag for doing that is minus only in.
Oh.
Which is very Englishy and very, very pleasant. So MDFind minus only in /documents kind colon PDF will give you all the PDFs in your documents folder.
I like that.
The other flag then is minus count, which doesn't tell you what the files are. It just tells you how many there are. And so if you want to answer the question, how many music files are there in my music folder? It would be MDFind minus only in /music minus count kind colon music. And I'm calling back here to a really old episode of the Nocillacast. If you want to answer the eternal questions, how many apps do I have installed?
Ooh.
And you want to go in and not just find the stuff at the top level of the applications folder, but to find the stuff inside the utilities folder and all that kind of stuff. The answer is MDFind space minus only in /applications space minus count space kind colon app.
So I would like to throw out a challenge to the Nocilla Castaways to see if anyone else has more applications than they do music.
I'm going to fail that.
I have 213 applications and 117 music files.
Well, I'm on my laptop now, and I only have 149 apps. But when I did it, when I tested this on my actual desktop machine yesterday, I had 243 apps.
And you have more music than that?
Oh, I had thousands.
I have bought 7 albums in my lifetime.
Although on the laptop, it's possible I have 0 music here. 8, damn it.
Oh, so you won.
Oh, I win.
A while ago, I know I've told the story before, it just cracks me up every time. Just as a joke, I took a screenshot of the music app on my iPhone where it said, "You have no music," and a bunch of people tried to help me fix it. you know what you need to do is you need to go back in sync and rubber.
No, I don't want any music.
You didn't get it. By the way, my music is full of music now, and I don't know where it's coming from.
Is it really there, or is it just cloud there?
It's cloud there, Bart, but I don't have Music Match, and I don't own these songs, and I never bought these songs. There are some that Steve owns, but we don't share an Apple ID.
And you never did? Not with kids? Not with anything?
The number of things that are in there that we have never seen before is vast. There are things that we recognize, but there's things like there's no way any of us would have ever listened to. I mean, it's unbelievable. I don't know where this stuff's coming from. And if we never put it in the cloud, how's it in the cloud? I don't understand. They got little cloudy buttons.
Well, that means that you just have the right to download them, but you didn't actually, they're not there.
But where did they come from?
Well, the U2 album's in there, and you got that for free from Apple.
Yeah, but
explains eight.
There's hundreds. I mean, it goes on and it's huge. I mean, I've scrolled four times and I'm only down to C. This is not me. Flip Flop Rock.
I don't know.
Outkast, Jay-Z, and Killer Mike. I don't think so. I don't know who these people... Okay, The Carpenters. That one's mine.
You haven't set up family sharing or something?
I have now. Oh, here we go. I'm not going to say the word out loud. F Police Brutality. That sounds like me.
I don't know.
Some of these might be my kids, but I don't know. Hey, here you go. Go-Karts by Bill Cosby. That one's me. All right. Well, let's see. This is cool, though. This is kind of neat. I like the idea of being able to count stuff. I could definitely see a use for this. I do find it interesting, the MD find, back you up a little bit, where you said only in as a command. That means if you don't say only in, it's looking everywhere?
Correct. By default.
You don't give it a directory?
Yeah, which is how it works in the Finder as well, because by default, it looks everywhere, and then you have to click the little button only in this folder.
Unless you set your default to be always checking this folder.
And I have no idea whether MD Find will obey the default in the Finder app. Probably not. It'll probably follow its own man pages.
I think you're right.
Probably is, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right, because it searched everywhere, and I'm pretty sure on some Mac and someday I set it to search this folder.
I keep meaning to do that, and I keep forgetting to. I really should. So this takes us to the end of our searching.
It definitely is. On this Mac, it is set to do this folder, the folder that I'm in, and it did not obey that in Terminal.
Which is fine, because the Terminal should do what the man page says. It shouldn't mysteriously not do what its man page says.
You should obey the man.
Yeah, you should obey the man, exactly. So this actually brings us to the end of our sort of our mini-series of searching. So we searched for text, we searched for files, we did stuff to the files, and then we did some cool Mac-only searches. And so the next sort of big mini-series is on networking, but that's a big topic. Oof. And it's going to be a fun topic, but it's going to be a big topic. So before we dive into that, I think we want to do a sort of a light segment in between, and that light segment is going to be some tips and tricks for using Bash.
Oh, goody.
Yeah, I've been sort of keeping a little note of, I must tell people about that, and I must tell people about that. So I'm just going to take that Evernote document, and that's going to be the next show.
Oh, cool. So we'll have a little aperitif in between, huh?
Exactly. And, you know, I doubt anyone's going to be interested in every single tip or trick, but I'd be very surprised if people didn't get at least something out of it.
Cool. Very, very cool. All right, Bart. Well, this was fun. Keep us up to date on what's going on with that whole Bash thing. I hope it doesn't change between now and tomorrow when I produce the show.
Goodness only knows. It's been such a quick moving story. But ultimately, it's kind of just install whatever updates you're given as a regular person and let the sysadmin stress out.
And buy them coffee.
And buy them coffee.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bart.
No worries. Until next time, happy computing.
All right. Well, I hope you had fun this time, but it's going to have to wind up the show. Many thanks for our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mega Learning at bluemegalearning.com, makers of Clarify. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions like Steve Davidson did. I love dumb questions, especially the kind I can answer. You can also send comments and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com, and you can follow me on Twitter and app.net@podfeet. Check out the No Silicast Google Plus community, too. I got to tell you, I go over there all the time to get answers to questions. And when people send me questions, a lot of times I say, can you go ask the community because they're smarter than me? And that seems to really work out well. That's over at podfeet.com/Google+. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, like, let's see, Jamal came back this week. CJ from Ann Arbor came back. Charles, I think his name is. And Anouk was here for a little while. I think he's cut out now, but Anouk was here. Never been here before. Had a really good time. We're having a blast in the live show. If you want to do that, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Join the friendly and enthusiastic No Silly Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.